You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, arguments have now been heard in a second lawsuit against state Republicans' lame duck laws. We'll hear what both sides had to say in Dane County Court this morning. Now, Wisconsin's unemployment rate has been at about 3% for the last year, dipping to 2.9% in February. This tight job market is one contributing factor to restaurants struggling to hire and retain enough employees to keep their kitchens open around the state. Of course, things like low wages, a tough work environment, and lack of benefits can deter workers from the restaurant industry as well. But many restaurants feel stuck. Things like charging more for menu items to offer better pay to a kitchen worker can mean bad reviews on sites like Yelp. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you own, manage, or work in a restaurant? What are the challenges to hire workers and to retain them once they're there? What changes do you see needed in the restaurant industry as a whole? And what's your experience as a restaurant worker? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christine Hilmer is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. She joins us in the studio. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
This problem has emerged more as the unemployment rate has gone down, but is this really a new problem?
It's really not a new problem. It's something that restaurants have faced for a long time.
And if it was a problem in the past when unemployment was higher, what does that say about the reasons why restaurants are having a hard time?
It's really a very complex issue. One of the reasons is that teenagers are really no longer working. They've got AP classes or there's sports teams that have practice and they have tournaments year round. So this is typically a great opportunity to learn soft skills, to learn how to work, to learn how to what the value of a paycheck and so on. And with this influx of or lack of influx of teenagers into restaurants, it really means that there's a lack of workforce to a traditional way for people to start working.
So it's not that they're not just interested in working in restaurants, they're just not working as much.
That's correct. Hmm.
The Capital Times newspaper in Madison published an extensive piece on how Madison area restaurants are struggling with hiring and retaining workers, but I'm guessing that this is actually a statewide issue.
It's not only a local, statewide, but it's a national problem. This is with a low unemployment rate, it's really tough finding workers.
And looking at the state as a whole, there are very different areas, very heavily urban areas, suburban, rural, small towns. Are there areas that have an even harder time finding people than other places?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think it's just across the board. People are having a difficult time finding and retaining good quality workers.
I will say, having lived in Madison for 30 years now, the rate at which new restaurants open is dizzying. You used to be able to almost try every new restaurant as it came out. I am probably about 400 restaurants behind at this point. Is that part of the challenge too? Are there more restaurants opening?
There are more restaurants opening, and that makes it challenging, not only for consumers looking for the latest, greatest restaurant, of which there are many, but it also makes it challenging because the competition for a restaurant is so high that the rate that they close is actually also high.
There are a lot that I never even got to try before they went away. Remind us how restaurant workers are paid, especially wait staff.
There's a thing called the tip credit. And the way the tip credit works, it's actually a way that you can increase your pay. So your minimum wage is lower, but you're still guaranteed the regular minimum wage, and the gap is filled by tips. Now, the beauty of the way the tip credit works is there's no ceiling then. If you work hard, you're a great wait staff, and you get great tips, your hourly wage can far exceed what that minimum wage is. Now, the difficulty, if you get rid of that tip credit, then you have a ceiling, and you always make that amount. If you really are a good server, worth your salt, you can really make a good living.
We heard from several listeners on Facebook where we asked about the challenges to hire and retain workers. Donna on Facebook pointed out that low wages, no benefits, fluctuating amount of hours, varying schedules, and difficult physical conditions can make the business unappealing. Is that something that you hear from people?
I know that restaurateurs are constantly looking at ways that they can improve their workforce, and that could be through employee engagement. Are there alternative ways that they can improve what they're offering to their staff? Because once you have a worker that's trained and really good at what they do and love being with people, they want to retain them. It's not easy. I'm not going to kid anybody, but if you're willing to work hard, you could really make it a career. That's the one thing that we also find, that for many people, it becomes more than just a job. It becomes a career. They like working with people. They want to exceed what they're currently doing. We've got a lot of stories of dishroom to the boardroom. So if you want to make more, try going into management. There are opportunities beyond being a wait staff or in the back of the house.
We are talking with Christine Hilmer right now. She's president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. And we're talking about the challenges that many restaurants face in finding staff and retaining staff to stay fully staffed to serve their clients. And one of the issues that Donna had pointed out on Facebook that I think is important is sometimes it can be hard to get benefits like health insurance when you're working for restaurants. Is that limit the types of people who might feel, even if they think they would enjoy it, if they have children, for instance, that they need to cover, or a spouse, might that limit who feels that they can work in a restaurant?
It can be limiting, but it can also offer a great deal of flexibility for somebody who doesn't need those kind of benefits. So say you are reentering the workforce, say you are a stay-at-home mom, or say you for some reason was out of the workforce. Well, this is a way to get back into it. There's a great deal of flexibility that you can get when you're working in restaurants, more so than a 9-to-5 job. But some restaurants do offer benefits, some don't. It's a challenge. The thing that restaurants face is that they have a profit margin of 3-5%. And what that means in real dollars is for every dollar a restaurant brings in, 95 to 97 cents already is spoken for in terms of rent, electricity, food costs, salary and labor, and so on. And so you're only talking about a 3-5 cents that's available. And so restaurants are being squeezed. On one hand, they would love to offer their staff benefits, greater wages, and so on. But then again, what their customers don't want to see a higher food cost. So restaurants are stuck in the middle, and that's a really narrow margin. And again, because we were just talking about, so the competition is high, they can't really raise their rates. And so many restaurants are starting and then ending that it becomes a real difficult dance. Restaurants would love to pay their staff more and would love to offer them benefits, but sometimes it's just not possible.
Let's go to the phones, and Lori in Green Bay is up. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I just honestly believe that they're short staffed because they don't pay. And it's a fallacy that they can't pay. It is also a fallacy that they want to pay. I think if you look at even just recently, a guy who was cited for not paying his staff properly, he made tons of money. He ended up with huge fines. He was easily able to pay the fines. And they don't want to pay their staff more. They want to keep them on the sub-wage.
Thanks for that call, Lori. And Christine, I'm sure that there are some restaurant owners like the one that Lori cited, but the members of your association, what do you hear about from them about how they would like to be able to treat their employees?
I really think that the example that the caller just gave is the exception and not the rule. You're always going to have some business owners that skirt the rules, don't pay their taxes, don't pay their staff, and really try not to do the right thing. 99% of restaurateurs really do want to do the right thing. This is their bread and butter. If they don't take care of their staff don't take care of their customers won't come back, and they're going to lose their business. The vast majority want to do the right thing, and I truly believe that. I talk with restaurateurs all the time that would say, if we could just do this one thing, we would pay them more, and so on. They're right now caught in the middle.
And as we wrap up, Christine, what would you say to someone who has maybe never worked in a restaurant, is looking for some work? What would you say they can gain from working in a restaurant? I have to say I gained a lot of really good skills, especially organization and prioritizing as a waitress.
I think you learn a lot of soft skills, and I'm going to have a challenge out to those parents of teenagers. Your teenagers are going to be in the workforce soon, and if they're not already, this is a way to teach them personality skills. How do you talk to somebody else? How are you polite? So soft skills, showing up on time, the value of a paycheck. Restaurants are a great way for them to start learning those skills because they're eventually going to have to learn that. And to those that may be looking for something part-time, something that has a great deal of flexibility, there's a lot of opportunity. You don't have to work part-time. Sometimes it's a part-time while the kids are at school. You can be a server, or there's just lots of opportunities. And it's more than just back of the house, in front of the house. There's management. There's food science. There's being a butcher. There's much more to food service than being just in a restaurant.
Well, Christine, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Christine Hilmer, the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. She joined us to talk about the restaurant industry's struggle to hire and retain staff. Coming up, we'll bring you up to speed on today's court activity involving the lame duck laws state Republicans passed in December. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, President Trump signed an executive order last week aimed at protecting free speech at public universities. We'll talk to a legal expert about what the order could mean and how colleges handle groups with opposing viewpoints. First, a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the state Republican lame duck laws is moving forward. A Dane County judge heard oral arguments this morning in a case being brought by a coalition of union groups. The laws were passed last December and signed into law by then-Governor Walker before he left office. They limit the attorney general's power to control state participation in lawsuits, restrict the governor's ability to run Wisconsin's Economic Development Agency, and limited early voting hours. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So plaintiffs in the first lawsuit were arguing the validity of the extraordinary session in which the laws were passed. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. But first, can you explain what the arguments are in this second lawsuit?
So this argument is really about separation of powers within the Capitol. So the plaintiffs in this case are contending that the laws passed during the lame duck legislative session give lawmakers too much power over the executive branch. Essentially, they're putting too many limitations on Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call.
And this lawsuit is being heard by a different judge than the one who's hearing the other one. Is that correct?
That's right. So this is the second of two state lawsuits. They are both being heard in Dane County Court. That's where they're originating. But there are different judges on each case.
In addition to asking Judge Remington to rule that Republicans violated the constitutional separation of powers, what action are the unions asking Remington to take?
Well, ideally in all of these lawsuits for the plaintiffs, they're asking the judges to throw out all of these lame duck laws, to essentially put back in place a lot of the powers that existed for former Governor Scott Walker before he left office. So some of the big things that we've talked about that passed during the lame duck session were things like limiting the governor's ability to leave federal lawsuits or the governor's power to change federal waivers. Governor Walker instituted a couple different federal waivers for work requirements and drug testing for things like Medicaid and food stamps. Governor Evers doesn't have the ability to make any changes to those federal waivers under current law. So what would happen in an ideal world for these plaintiffs would be for all of those powers to be returned to the governor.
And what are state Republican lawmakers saying in defense of their position? Because clearly they want to keep these last-minute legislative moves in place.
Absolutely. They think that these laws are incredibly important to maintaining a balance of power in the Capitol. They say that, you know, with the Democratic governor coming in, the Democratic attorney general, they want to make sure that the will of the voters who elected them is honored in an appropriate way as laws are passed, as laws are defended, as actions are taken. Essentially, their argument when they passed all of these laws in December was that the governor shouldn't be able to, with the stroke of a pen, undo what Republican lawmakers and a Republican administration had done for, you know, the 8 years previous.
I remember when that was all going on, there were some Republican legislators who said, well, these were measures that we meant to take before and we just hadn't gotten around to it, so we're doing it now. Mm-hmm. Is that argument making its way into this lawsuit at all?
I haven't heard that in court arguments in either of these state cases that had arguments last week and then this morning. I think that kind of preserving that balance of power, and that certainly was something that lawmakers said when the debate was happening back in December, that they really thought that that balance of power was a little bit out of whack, and maybe they could have, should have, would have done some of these things when Governor Walker was in office, but they just didn't get around to it. So I think that that is kind of their argument, saying that, you know, these are things that are just sound policy regardless of who's in office.
What was the atmosphere in the courtroom this morning when Judge Remington was hearing from both sides?
Well, Judge Remington is asking some tough questions of both sides, as judges are wont to do. He's particularly interested in the defendants' arguments about lawmakers wanting a seat at the table. That's something that their lawyer, who's a privately hired lawyer to defend Republican state lawmakers in the legislature, has said that Republicans put a number of these measures in place to ensure that they were part of discussions as different state policy proposals, laws, et cetera, move forward. They also talked quite a bit about in court the need to have someone step forward and defend laws when they're challenged in court. That's another part of this lame duck package, is allowing lawmakers to hire private representation if they feel like the liberal, you know, Democratic attorney general wouldn't do as robust of a job in defending laws that they pass. So that's certainly been an extensive line of questioning from the judge as well, as he weighs what kind of decision he wants to make in this.
Do we have any sense of when Judge Remington might make some sort of ruling on this?
There are different timelines. It was just a couple days last week. A different Dane County judge ruled pretty quickly. But there aren't any sort of deadlines on actions like this. We do know that Republican lawmakers have pushed for decisions to be made quickly because they kind of want to put this behind them. And they are arguing that if any of these provisions are thrown out, the word that they've been using quite a bit is chaos. You know, if these new legislative proposals, these new laws, rather, are taken off the books, and in addition, the number of appointments that were made during this lame duck session, that just creates a lot of uncertainty and moving pieces within state government.
We're talking with Laurel White. She is WPR's state capitol reporter, and we're talking about lawsuits that have been filed regarding the lame duck legislation that was passed in December. Laura, let's go back to last week when Judge Richard Neese blocked all of the lame duck laws. That was the result of a suit being brought by the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin and other groups. What was the basis of that lawsuit?
So that lawsuit was a more procedural argument. Essentially, what they were arguing was that lawmakers didn't have the power to call a lame duck session to begin with. They said that that isn't something that's ascribed to the legislature within the state constitution. The constitution gives the governor power to call a special session, but not lawmakers to call an extraordinary session. And that's what they did in the instance of December's lame duck. And they've done this numerous times over the past several decades, actually. Extraordinary sessions have been happening in Wisconsin since about 1980. There have been about two dozen of them. Basically, they're called when lawmakers don't have a regularly scheduled session day, but they want to come in and take care of some business. So this argument, though, was that because that's not ascribed in the state constitution, they didn't have the power to do it, and therefore the extraordinary session should be considered null and void.
And we will be checking in with WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson on the latest on that case tomorrow. But Laurel, it seems to me, a non-legal mind, that if the case that's in front of Judge Neese, if he upholds the injunction against that, that basically that would also be weighing in on the union's lawsuit as well, since that's kind of tucked up under that umbrella.
Well, it's interesting because obviously these numerous lawsuits about the lame duck session are all having to do with these laws that were passed in this specific amount of time, but they all do have very different arguments, and they do all operate very much independently of each other. So we had Judge Neese's ruling last week. We'll get a different ruling from Judge Remington in this other case, and all of these cases will be able to continue along on parallel tracks. However they are decided, ruled on, they will continue to operate independently. Obviously, the laws that are being argued today in Judge Remington's court are currently off the books because of Judge Neese's ruling, so it's a little bit wonky. But because each of these cases can be appealed to a higher court, all of the cases will continue until they kind of reach that ultimate place where they just can't go any further.
Are these the only two lawsuits that are currently making their way through the courts that deal with the lame duck session?
These are the only two state lawsuits. There are two federal lawsuits, though, that have to do with the lame duck session. One of them has already had a ruling. A federal judge in January struck down the early voting restrictions that were passed as part of the lame duck legislative session. That is currently before a federal appellate court. Arguments haven't been heard in that case yet. Then there is a second federal suit, which was filed by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and that says that the session violated the U.S. Constitution's guarantee clause, which guarantees individuals a Republican form of government, Republican not with a capital R, Republican in terms of, them being represented by the people that they voted for.
Well, a whole lot to keep track of. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laura White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about this morning's oral arguments in Dane County Court on a second lawsuit against the lame duck laws passed by state Republicans last year. This one is being brought by several union groups. It contends that Republicans violated the constitutional separation of powers between the legislative and executive branches. And since our conversation with Laurel this morning, Judge Frank Remington said that he would hand down a ruling on the case tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk about the implications of an executive order signed last week by President Trump focusing on ensuring free speech rights on college campuses. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 7:15 on The Morning Show, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has delayed Obama-era payday lending regulations from taking effect. Host John Munson and his guest will discuss the debate over payday lending, how it works, and what impact regulations have. That's tomorrow morning, right here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump signed an executive order last week aimed at requiring public universities to ensure free speech rights on campus as a condition of receiving federal research grants. How the order would be enforced wasn't made clear. Before signing the order last Thursday, Trump delivered a statement at the White House. Here's a listen.
Taxpayer dollars should not subsidize anti-First Amendment institutions, and that's exactly what they are, anti-First Amendment. Universities that want taxpayer dollars should promote free speech, not silence free speech.
The executive order also looks to increase reporting about academic outcomes and salary levels for college graduates as a way to help manage the problem of student debt. Laura Schwartz is lecturer in the Department of Government at American University, where she also directs the Project on Civil Discourse. She's author of the book How to College, What to Know Before You Go and When You Get There, which comes out next month. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What jumped out to you about what this executive order said or didn't say?
Sure. Well, what jumps out is, you know, there isn't much there. There's very little. It says there's maybe one operative sentence that says these departments are supposed to take measures to ensure that free inquiry is promoted. And what isn't there is what really jumps out. There's not any guidance that could give a university any sense of when it's violated this order. In that, I think there could be a real chilling effect on universities engaging in research, engaging in how they're running on-campus programs with outside speakers. So what I see is something vague and overbroad, and that would be the major problem.
So it sounds like you're saying that the lack of specifics, the lack of clarity, could actually be more restrictive than if it was spelled out more clearly.
Absolutely. The thing is when you think about being open to free speech, and universities are. It's really striking about the statement you just played. You know, universities are anti-First Amendment institutions. You'd be hard pressed to find a context that's more about and more embracing of conversation about tough ideas than a university. There's not a workplace that you'll find generally where you'll see more rigorous debate. So that really stands out as a way of talking about universities that doesn't ring true with those of us who are in them. Legally, speaking, restrictions on federal funds, they need to be clear. The people who are bound by any law need to be able to act on it and understand what a violation would look like. In this case, when you think about the examples that at the CPAC conference that Trump gave in justifying a future executive order, there was an incident where a non-student assaulted another non-student at Berkeley, and the issue was treated as the criminal assault that it was, and authorities were called, and the assault was investigated. In a time when a school delayed a speaker coming so they could set up proper security for their presence. So hard to understand what problem he's really identifying here.
So could this apply to private universities and colleges that get some federal money, or is this really geared towards public universities?
Well, here's the thing. The order says that private universities, so for your listeners, the First Amendment of our Constitution is a limitation on the government's power to prevent speech, right? So it says that, the government doesn't punish speech based on viewpoint. And so at public universities, the administrations are, and faculty, everyone are bound to allow free inquiry, allow free expression with limits for safety and things like harassment. And private universities are free, though, because they're not the government, to set restrictions. And that they might be engaging in bad behavior if they're limiting what people can say or think or do, but they're not violating the First Amendment because they're not the government. Most private universities, including the one where I work, American University, take free speech seriously enough to have adopted rules that say we act as if we were the government. We act, we act completely coextensive with the First Amendment. What the executive order says is that private schools are supposed to be abiding by the guidelines and rules that they set up for themselves, whatever that means.
We're talking with Laura Schwartz right now. She's lecturer in the Department of Government at American University, where she also directs the Project on Civil Discourse. She's the author of the book, How to College, What to Know Before You Go and When You Get There, which comes out next month. And we're talking about the newly announced executive order dealing with free speech on campuses and tying federal research dollars to compliance with that. And Laura, this is an issue that has come up fairly frequently recently, often from conservative politicians and sources. Do you have a sense of when this really became kind of one of the fundamental issues on the conservative side of the political spectrum?
Well, there has been an increasing partisan divide in our opinions regarding higher education, regarding whether colleges, universities, professors are you know, in general, making the world a better place, or they aren't. And that partisan divide has been there for some decades. If you look at research, the partisan divide on the sort of approval of what colleges do sharply increased around 2015, 2016. So in the Trump era, the partisan divide about higher education is wider. There's been a gripe, I guess, about universities that they must be liberal or they must be biased for some decades now. I think a fever pitch like you saw with that CPAC announcement is more recent. Looking back broadly through history, our kind of current First Amendment law, our current academic freedom principles that we have about, you know, professors, researchers, universities, built up in the, you know, early and mid 20th century due to attacks on liberal professors who were professing, who, you know, might be talking about more radical or even Marxist economic ideas. And the free speech movement on campus really was born at University of California at Berkeley, where students asserting their free speech rights. So free speech on campus has a fairly liberal and progressive pedigree. The lens through which incidents with conservative speakers, particularly controversial speakers facing protests, is shown to America as this is what speech is like on campus, I'd say is a fairly new lens.
And is there actual data that can be pointed to that shows a breakdown of, you know, if it's obviously there are speakers that come to campuses that are not talking about political issues, that are not representing a part of the political spectrum, that are talking about something totally different. But of those that could be assigned a label of, say, conservative or liberal, do we have any sense of how the numbers come out?
Well, I don't know the numbers of who's coming to speak on campus. It wouldn't be a great metric, though, for how open people are to free speech. And here's why. Freedom of speech means getting to choose which speaker you want, who you want to bring to a campus. So if the students on a campus are overwhelmingly liberal because that community from which they're drawn, let's say, is overwhelmingly liberal, and this generation, so there are non-traditional college students, but just let's say the 18 to 22-year-old who's kind of the residential campus likely student, are also somewhat more on the liberal side. If they're choosing who to bring and they're saying, you know, I'm interested in hearing this liberal sociologist or this person, this economist or politician, and they're organizing that, if the universities put their thumb on the scale and said, well, you know, that's all well and good, but we want you to bring somebody else because that's not you know, that's not conservative enough, and we want a flat percentage or a quota or something. You know, arguably they would be interfering with the students. So I don't think that's a good metric of whether people are open to free speech and debate. Now, we do have good data, though, on what college students think about free speech. College students are as open or more so to First Amendment protections as the public at large. And overwhelmingly, I think it's about 90%, say that freedom of speech and the First Amendment is very, very important to our society. They also tend to value inclusion, and some larger number of liberal students than conservative students say that inclusion and inclusivity might even be more important than free speech. But students overwhelmingly, college students across party and ideology lines, don't support, for example, small minorities of either party students or any party support, for instance, disrupting or excluding speakers.
We're talking with Laura Schwartz right now. She's director of the Project on Civil Discourse at American University, and we're looking at the president's executive order aimed at ensuring free speech rights in higher education. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1061. 1234. Do you think this is a problem on college campuses? Is threatening to withhold federal funding the right way to ensure multiple viewpoints are heard? If you're a college student or an educator, how do you think the exchange of ideas is working at your school? And if you're the parent of kids who might be going to college soon, is this something on your mind? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our talk with Lara Schwartz, Director of the Project on Civil Discourse at American University, and we're talking about the President's executive order meant to ensure a free exchange of ideas at public universities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's an imbalance of free speech in higher education? Do you think the government should be withholding funding or research money to make sure certain viewpoints get heard? And if you're a student, how do you assess the situation at your school? Do you think this executive order is needed, or are concerns about free speech on campus overblown? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Lara, James on Facebook said that he's looking forward to hearing about pro-abortion rights causes and LGBT speakers on conservative campuses if the goal really is free speech. And Dave writes on Facebook that the problem with free speech is everyone defines it how they want to define it. So that to me gets to kind of the heart of this is, what is free speech and who decides?
Sure. So, yes, on the pro-abortion, pro-LGBT on conservative campuses, a story did come out today looking at how Liberty University has at times apparently tried to censor or put their thumb on the scale with student journalists expressing various viewpoints, shut down college Democrats. So, absolutely, there are I think that is a fair point. What is free speech and who decides? So there's the legalistic answer, right? The government can't be punishing speech based on viewpoint. It can make time, place, or manner restrictions. So we can't be, campus free speech doesn't mean you can use a megaphone in your residence hall at midnight, please, to talk about your favorite candidate or anything else. Place and manner, you can't be harassing people and threatening them. And those aren't protected speech. One thing that comes out of this concern about free speech on campus that you hear these two questions. Free speech is literally, not preventing people from speaking through government intervention and punishment. And then this other much different question of whether people feel comfortable expressing a particular viewpoint on campus. So they might say, 80% of my fellow students at University of Wisconsin are more liberal than me. So if I talk about how I oppose abortion, they really won't like it or they'll make fun of me. And so I don't feel free. And that's a serious thing for a student at a university to be grappling with. It's not a free speech question, though. And I find that in these conversations, the two questions, is one viewpoint popular, welcomed, particularly respected amongst your peers on your campus? And is the government interfering with your speech and your expression? They're different, but to a student off, at college for the first time, trying to use her voice, make herself heard, have a social network, make an impact in the community, maybe that sense of being odd man out, though, is significant anyway, without being a free speech issue.
I want to bring some of our listeners on. First, Tom in Port Wing is up. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I think there's a misunderstanding of what is desired through this, order. And one of them is simply to get both sides of an issue. If you have a socialist on, then you have a person who speaks of the opposite capitalist side. If you have, that's how you get young people to understand both sides of the issue rather than just saying, well, the students only want this kind of a speaker. But the students don't always know what is best for them, and sometimes they need to actually be sat down and hear the other side of an issue rather than just close your mind off and say, I don't believe in this.
Thanks, Tom. I want to make sure we have time to bring on a couple other listeners. So let's go directly to Samuel in Milwaukee now. Samuel, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What would you like to add?
So I'm on the executive board of the College Republicans at UW-Milwaukee, and I would say that I think our university does far better than others that have received negative media attention over, you know, canceling conservative speaker events and such. I think that I've noticed that, and I'm a veteran and a non-traditional student, so I'm a little bit older than everybody else, but I've noticed that often a single employee who's unable to separate their political bias from their job at the university can often kind of paint perception for young conservatives or maybe in the opposite case, young liberal students as to how the university feels overall in supporting their First Amendment rights and free speech. And so I think this legislation or this executive order kind of reminded me of the changes in the in Bill Clinton's administration to the discrimination policies where companies became liable for discrimination by their employees. And so I see this as a good way to get skin in the game for universities to perhaps look at removing staff members who can't separate their political bias.
Thanks for that call, Samuel. And let's move to Susan in Mountain, Wisconsin. Hi, Susan.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that people are always forgetting that free speech also entails the protest against these conservative speakers at the universities. I think the conservatives just never like it when they're in the minority, because what the students are doing when they protest it and cause it to not happen, that is free speech.
And thank you for that call, Susan. I think Matt in Johnson Creek actually has something to address that. Matt, what did you have for us?
Yes, exactly. I think the so-called heckler's veto or mob censorship is really just a different clause in the First Amendment, which is the right to assemble. And I don't know how you can turn one on the other and actually enforce it with any sort of consistency. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. So a lot of perspectives there. Lara, what were you hearing from our callers?
Well, it's interesting. I think the question of free speech by protesters of speeches, it's a really important point. And University of Wisconsin-Madison, I know, created protest guidelines that attempt to suss out what constitutes protected protest of a visiting speaker versus a disruptive protest. So if you cross a line from asserting your First Amendment right to say, hey, this speaker's terrible, to making it impossible for other people to hear that speaker. So I think the University of Wisconsin has been trying to grapple with that. On the showing students both sides, I would remind the caller, you know, that's why one reason it's great that we have classes, and I love getting my students' feedback about what they want to learn, but I write my syllabi, and they don't. And in the academic, hopefully they read them. In the academic world, it's really, really important for us to present a balanced view of whatever the topic is we're teaching, so people can really become educated about it, not what I think or who I voted for, but a good, solid set of credible sources that enable a student to navigate an issue. And hopefully.
And we'll have to leave it there, Laura. Thanks so much for joining us. Laura Schwartz is the director of the Project on Civil Discourse at American University. She was with us to talk about President Trump's executive order on campus free speech and its implications. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we talk with an expert on jury selection about why the idea of being judged by a panel of your peers is in danger of disappearing. And we'll ask you to share your experiences of sitting on a jury. The Mueller report has been released, but there are other investigations that are still active. We'll find out what the fate of those inquiries might be. All that and more tomorrow on Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6:30, only 24 human beings have visited the moon, which is the only space destination we visited. John Munson is filling in for Kate Archer-Kent this week. John and his guests look at what we can learn from the experiences of that very small, very special group of people. That's tomorrow morning after 6:30, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about mass incarceration in the United States and why one group says both ends of the criminal justice reform debate are getting some things wrong. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.